in effect, clinical ethics mediation. And I'm Ed Bergman, and as many of you know, I am the director of the clinical ethics program here at the center. My own background is and training is in law, but over the past 20-some years, both my practice and my academic interest have pretty much shifted into the sphere of dispute resolution and, in particular, mediation. And over the last 17 years, I've been teaching negotiation-related subjects at the Wharton School, and for the last 7 years, the clinical mediation courses here at the center. Excuse me. Now, some of you who are in this class have already had what we call one or more of the intensive courses. And I don't know if everybody is familiar with the curriculum in that regard, but the intensive courses can be taken independent of this course, although for purposes of getting a, I don't know whether it's called a certification or a, you guys probably know better than me what you get if you take both this course and a certain number of the intensives. They combine to, in effect, give you that special, that subspecialization. Now, in the intensive course, and the distinction is this, from what we're doing here over this semester, is that we throw you into the pool, or the ocean, as the case may be, and we simply give you, with the exception of a relatively brief introduction from me in the course of maybe an hour, 2 hours, whatever it is, some background about what mediation is all about. But primarily, we're just letting you go out there and sink or swim. And eventually, by the end of that session, which usually always lasts, not usually, always lasts, 4 full days, 8 hours a day, you have a pretty good idea of what some of the dynamics of mediation are and what the challenges particularly are and how difficult and demanding a role it is to be a mediator, particularly in the sphere of healthcare. The problem, as I see it, with learning only in the context of the intensives is simple, and that is you don't really get a background to any great degree in the theory or the literature of the subject. And in consequence, you also never get to really understand that because mediation is often defined as a form of assisted negotiation, the notion that you're going to teach people, think about this, to become specialized mediators in a clinical healthcare context before they have an appropriate background in classical mediation, its theory and techniques and the literature, and before that, a background to some degree in the theory and principles of negotiation behavior, because after all, if mediators are assisting negotiation, how can you really learn to become an effective mediator if negotiation concepts are something that you have no notion of? Okay, so from that perspective, what we're going to do here in this course is not throw you right into the water and see if you sink or swim, but try to build a context. Try to build an understanding of how mediation fits into the dispute resolution perspective, how negotiation concepts are relevant and necessary to master for the prospective mediator, and then ultimately talk about what some of the distinctions are that distinguish mediation in a healthcare context from classical mediation as it is utilized in a legal or business context. Okay, so that's really the vector, if you will, of the course. Do all of you have a copy of the syllabus? I hope you do. And it was available. It was available online. Is there anyone who doesn't have one? Good. So let's take, before we start with any substantive material, let's review the syllabus, and that will help us understand what our obligations are during the course of the semester, how the timeline is going to work, when we have class, when we don't have class, and what aspects of the material will be things that involve the grading in the course. So if we start at the beginning, you'll see, first of all, that we have two books that you're to purchase. One is Getting to Yes, the latest edition, and the other, Bioethics Mediation by Dubler and Liebman. This is also a revised, expanded edition, and these were listed on the syllabus for you to acquire. But in addition to that, there are probably the bulk of the readings that are on Blackboard that are accessible to you, along with copies of the PowerPoints that I use in the classes. So everybody will be able to easily access all of that material. Start out by, in the syllabus, making it clear that a big part of this course, although it won't be for a couple of weeks that this commences, will be, in fact, participation in role plays. And as a result of that, it's extremely important that people attend every class, or as near to every class as is possible. The reason being, not because I don't think you are not bright enough to catch up, or because there's going to be a problem with doing readings or even having discussions with me that would help bring you up to speed. The problem is that you're being given a role-playing assignment with members of your class, so that if you do not show up, they're there short a member of their negotiating group. And what happens is I then have to recast the pairings, often resulting in people playing, multiple people playing the same role, which is not the end of the world, but isn't really fair to people who would otherwise have had the opportunity to play the role unilaterally without interaction with another co-player. Because having a co-player, as you can imagine, creates separate and distinct problems from the problems that you have to deal with playing a role, be it mediator or one of the other parties. It's tough enough to do that, but for you to coordinate with somebody who's your alter ego, as to who's going to do what when, and who is going to take what position, adds another dimension to the problem that you don't need at this point. So, having said that, if you have an emergency that precludes you from being in class on a week that we have a game, a role play in class, let me know ahead of time if it's at all possible. Now, I realize there are rare instances in which people have a sudden illness or an emergency, and I am obviously not going to sit here and say to you, you can't be in this class if you ever miss one. That's not the case. I just want you to realize you have to prioritize not missing a class that you don't absolutely need to miss. So let's look at page 2, grading and course requirements. 30% of the grade is about the class participation, which consists of two different components. One is the extent to which you participate in the dialogue in class, the class discussion. That class discussion may be during or after a lecture portion. It may be in a debriefing after a game. But there'll be many interactive moments in this class where you'll be welcomed to and be expected to contribute. And that's part of class participation, as is your participation in the role plays. And the fact that you're expected, where it's indicated. If I give you, for example, a roll sheet to bring home, knowing that that game is going to be played the next week in class, it will be expected that you have read and digested that roll sheet so that when you begin to interact with your classmates in that particular exercise, you're not going to be going like this every minute as though you've never heard of this before, you've never seen it, and you're just looking at it for the first time. All of that is part of class participation. There will be a midterm exam. It's a take-home exam. And if you look at page... Let's see. I know it's here. February 7th, Class 7, distribute midterm exam. And then... February 23rd, Class 7. And then you hand in your midterm exam the following week. As a result, in addition to the spring break that falls on the March 8th class, which we will not have because of spring break, we will also be excused on March 15th because, in effect, you will be doing a midterm exam at home that I'm giving you class credit for. So we'll have those 2 weeks in which there is no class. God bless you. In each case, I've given you the readings for the subsequent class in the syllabus, as well as what is a reasonably good list, I think, of the overheads and other materials that we use. And as you go through, you'll see that there are a number of cases where we're going to do fundamentally the games during class and then debrief them at the end of the playing of the games. But in addition, we will then at some point begin to choose our teams and topics for the final project. Now, you can do the final project in groups up to four without asking for permission. If you want to do it with more than four, and the subject that you've chosen and how challenging it is consistent with needing more people or being able to employ more people on that project, I'm not going to be unreasonable and say no. The nature of the final project, as will become clear when we start to discuss them, could be anything from a research paper on a subtopic in clinical ethics negotiation that we address, or on mediation proper, that we address during the course of the semester. It can also be, and very frequently is, you and your teammates creating a clinical role play with teaching notes. The teaching notes, in effect, utilize the literature that you have read in class and any other outside material you might want to bring into play as a method of pedagogically teaching the subjects that you intended your game to be able to teach, meaning to illuminate topics in clinical ethics mediation that students in a class like this might be given, and you are explaining to the instructor how that instructor will maximize the pedagogical utility of that game that you've created. You will also then play that game with people either in the class or outside of the class and report on what you have observed about the role play as implemented, because here's what happens very frequently. You write a role play, you think it is going to illuminate topics A, B, and C. Lo and behold, it's not the case. It turns out that when people actually play the game, it goes off in directions that you had never anticipated. What often happens is that you can go back and identify why that happened and make a revision or revisions to your roll sheets and then play the game again to see if the revision impacted the usability of the game for the purposes that you intended. Now, you don't have to be playing, you know, writing notes, minute notes about this now. This will all evolve, and we'll talk about it later when it gets closer to the time for talking about the subjects as well as the teams. And then you'll notice that as we get to the end of the semester, in the final two classes, the groups who have come together to form teams for the final projects will actually make a preliminary oral presentation, usually with visual assists of you know, the, what you might expect, PowerPoints, whatever you seek to use, to basically describe to me and to the class what it is that your project is intended to achieve and how, and to open the floor to questions and comments from your classmates. And as we approach that point, we'll schedule in advance which teams and groups are going to present on which day. So that's basically the format of the class. Again, before we get started on substantive issues, I would like it if we would all briefly introduce ourselves so I can get to know not only who you are, and I do have, most of you know, I have name tags for you, and I would appreciate it for the first few weeks, if you can remember, that you actually wear them, unless I already know you, in which case, obviously, you don't have to wear them. But those of you who have been in intensives, I know, or I thought I knew and called Larissa Lizette before. So I apologize for that. But in any event, if you haven't been in intensive, do me a favor and wear them and make them visible if you could. Thank you, Sabreed. So let me just call the roll first, and then when I call the roll, perhaps you can just respond by telling us who you are and where you are academically and what you're doing in the class, in the sense that, oh, I'm an MBE student in the bioethics program, such and such a year, or I'm here as a law student getting a joint degree, or whatever else describes your relationship to the class. So let me start with Jonathan Anthony.
Great.
Jonathan.
Hi, I'm a full-time MBE student, and I also work in Washington, D.C. at a public health clinic and applying to medical school in the fall.
It's great. Thank you. Gabriella?
Hello, everybody. I'm Gabriella. I come from France. I'm an exchange student, and I'm a graduate, and I chose this class because it's going to help me with my research this year.
Thank you. Caroline?
I'm Caroline. I'm a full-time MBA student. I'm scheduled to graduate in May, and I'm in the process of applying to genetic counseling programs.
What are you applying to?
Genetic counseling.
Oh, great. Nandini?
I'm actually a first-year MSW student, and it's my first bioethics class. I was mainly drawn to it because I wanted to be a better advocate, and I felt some good things.
Very good. Sheena? Is Sheena here? Not here. Sabreed? Yes.
I'm actually a pharmacy student, and I'm taking a class out of interest to see if it would apply to anything that I want to do with my future.
That's wonderful. My father was a pharmacist. Rachel?
I'm a joint law student and MBE, and I'm graduating both in the spring.
Okay. You are not related by any chance to Alan Farnsworth?
Not that I know of, no.
Do you know who Alan?
I'm sure far back, yeah. Yeah, I know. Everybody asks me at the law.
They ask you the same thing?
Yeah, all the professors
ask me. Okay. Yeah, right. He was my contracts team.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Jenna Glassenberg? No? Now, Sotonye is in class but will not be here. She's a medical student, will not be here for the first 3 weeks. But I will find ways taping of those classes to have her catch up. Yash Joshi? Yes?
Hi, everybody. I'm an MD PhD student at Temple, and I'm also in the MD program. To those of you who took the intensives, I apologize if there's any weird wording, because I was part of the team that edited the case scenarios with Autumn for that.
Right. So, none at all. Yeah. Jacqueline Cates?
I'm a second-year MSW student, graduating in the spring. I took this class to just see if I want to work in a hospital setting as a social worker.
That's great. Joshua Kaiser?
Hi, I'm Josh.
Josh?
Physician at Penn. I'm the medical ICU director at the VA, and an MBA student, and I'm in this class because I specialize in ICU palliative care and end-of-life care.
That's great. Thanks. Thank you. Ken?
I'm a lawyer and an MBE student in my last semester, and took the class because I've done mediation as a lawyer in the commercial context, and I'm interested in the similarities and differences between that and mediation in a clinical context.
And Ken has taken the intensive, as has Carolyn, as has not Lizette, as has Larissa. I think the only ones who completed are those three. Yes? No, I don't think I missed anybody. Okay. Emily Kramer-Golenkoff?
Yep, that's me. I'm Emily. I work in marketing for Penn Medicine. And I'm also an MBE student, and this is, I think, my eighth class.
Very good, Emily. Jennifer Hoffbeck-Morrissey?
I completed the MBE program in 2009. I'm a nurse practitioner. I'm also the director of subject protection for the CTRCs at Penn Shop and the location at Presby. And I also sit on the ethics committee at Penn.
Oh, good.
And I've done consults. So I guess I did the sink or swim method.
Thank you.
I've been a nurse for months.
This should be very relevant for you.
Yeah.
Victoria Velasquez?
I'm a third-year JD MBE student as well.
Okay. Josh Weinstock?
I'm a full-time MBE student applying to medical school for the fall.
Okay. And last but not least, Larissa?
Larissa, I'm an MBE student. And I'm
going to
complete my mediation certificate.
Okay.
I think that Nora just...
Yes, I missed Vivian.
Mm-hmm. I think Nora just added me yesterday, which is maybe why I updated, and I'm also a third-year JD MBE student.
Wonderful. Yes. Yes, Leah, I knew that you were new, and I do have a... Yeah, there it is. Okay. And you're a law student also?
Yes, I'm a third-year law student. This is my first bioethics class, and I'm in my last semester, so I wanted to take something for a little bit of variety.
But you're not a joint degree.
I'm not a joint degree.
Okay. Okay. Did I miss anybody else? Great.
Oh, one more.
Oh, I'm sorry. Shoot.
I'm Barak, I'm a new student.
You're going to have to speak louder for me.
I'm Barak, I'm a new student. I'm from Tanzania.
Okay.
Yeah, just come take an MVP.
I believe that you're trying to decide whether you're going to take this class or one other class. Is that correct, or are you...
I decided to take this one, but I was asking if I can take four courses. And Nora said you go to ask if we are allowed to take four.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good, Barak. Thank you. Now, let's see if we can get our technology stuff in order. By the way, I was serious. Is there anybody who is good at this stuff and likes to play with the computer? Because usually what I do in the beginning of all my Wharton classes and my CBE classes is get an assistant who basically runs the slides and the videos so that I can walk around and not be tied to the machine. Would anybody be willing to play that role? That's great. Why don't you come up here? Because also I'm a computer imbecile, in addition to other disabilities. So what we're going to do here is begin the first slide. So you need to go see that these are the slides, mm-hmm. and there are also videos. They're noted as for class one.
Okay.
When something is not in order, which won't be frequently, I'll let you know.
Okay.
Or when we have to go back, I'll let you know. So if we could just begin with
sure.
that slide, and let me get the lights down a little bit. Can everybody see well enough to write? Is this good?
That's good.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Now, if you look at the first slide, you will see that this depicts a young kid who seems to be sweating it out, because, lo and behold, he has been placed into the position of having to negotiate God knows what. It could be his allowance. It could be where to take his pal for his birthday or whatever. And this slide obviously indicates negotiation. It's not child's play. Obviously, to convey to you that the notion of negotiation as a form of human behavior, while in fact it is something we all do and have done from the very earliest times, very few people are formally trained in negotiation and know very much about it. They may have different levels of sort of innate ability in dealing with the subject, but surprisingly, although they must utilize that those skills all the time, they get very little training in it. So on the one hand, there's an irony to this slide, because it says negotiation, it's not child's play, but you know what, it is child's play, because you learn to negotiate from the first minute you can talk, if not before. And if I could have the next slide, what I want to do is give you one of many definitions of negotiation. And here, this definition is a joint decision-making process through which two or more interdependent parties seek to resolve a dispute or create a shared vision, notwithstanding the existence of conflicting interests. Now, that's a mouthful, because the first thing that jumps out at me is the notion that this is a joint decision-making process. And what that implies, and what is indeed true for the phenomenon of negotiation, is that there is no point in the existence of a negotiation unless the parties are in some way interdependent. So that we mean when we say a joint decision-making process, that those parties who are in some interdependent relationship to one another are jointly seeking either the resolution of the dispute or creation of a shared vision. Another very important distinction. Most people think about negotiation as dispute resolution, But remember, we need not have a dispute in order to negotiate a relationship going forward, which is indeed what we do all the time when, for example, we get involved in a in some sort of joint venture in business, when we form a partnership, we form a corporation, we form a foundation, we start a relationship of an informal or formal sort for which we seek to find guidelines for how that relationship will be structured. Okay? And that's what we mean by creating a shared vision, because there doesn't have to be a dispute in order for negotiation to be required and appropriate. And notwithstanding the existence of conflicting interests, that part of the definition deals with the fact that if there were absolutely no conflicting interests, there are 100% identity of interests, while there might be an attempt at negotiation, it would probably end as soon as one realized that we didn't have any differences. We wouldn't really need to negotiate. In other words, if we were to find out that I'm selling you this ring and I have a price in mind, and in fact it turns out that you want this ring and no other ring, and you were already coming to me with the expectation you were going to pay the price that I was asking, there wouldn't be anything else left to do. Okay. So now, again, keep in mind these components as we go forward. And let me have the next slide, if I could. Here are some concepts in negotiation that you need to be familiar with at the outset, that anybody who has any familiarity with negotiation understands. We've already talked about the interdependency. The next thing I want to talk about is communication. It's not going to come as a surprise to you that what we do when we're negotiating is that we communicate with one another, or at least we attempt to communicate with one another effectively. That, however, is more easily said than done, as by the end of the semester you'll fully appreciate. Let me have, if you will, the next slide, and we'll come back to this one. So here's a definition of communication: a process by which information, underlined, is exchanged between individuals through a common system of symbols, signs, or behavior. A technique for expressing ideas effectively, and then parentheses, as in speech. Now, this is the Merriam-Webster definition, and it also has a lot of important components. So, first of all, when we are communicating with one another in order to negotiate, what we are in fact communicating is fundamentally information. The common system of symbols, signs, or behavior would be, for example, the English language. It might be mathematics. But you know what? It might be something not as easy to categorize as that. It might be gestures. It might be other ways of indicating non-verbally emotional content, exasperation, unhappiness, anxiety, whatever. And then they talk about expressing ideas effectively, not just expressing ideas, but expressing them effectively. Now let's look at the next definition, which is an interesting combination, if I could. There's next slide. Here's the definition in the same dictionary of communicate.
So we have to transmit information, thought, or feeling. So that becomes a little bit more expansive all of a sudden. Not quite sure why, but this would be a broader definition to me of what is fundamentally the same notion, and but they're making sure that they're distinguishing between information, thought, or feeling. It's a little bit vague, because what I was suggesting to you is that I read the initial definition as meaning that thought and feeling was also information, and the effectiveness in the first definition is kind of expressed by the notion of being satisfactorily received or understood. That would be sort of synonymous. And then to reveal by clear signs, which again could be language, could be body language, could be facial expressions, could be tenor, or even could be the decibel level, among many, many other possibilities. So let me see if you can get me the video, the first video.
Which is located...
It should be... So it's on a, in a different folder. Class 1 videos.
Class 1 film clips.
Yeah, film clips, that's fine.
Which one would you like?
Well, it should be in order, but this would be take the money and run.
Okay.
So let's take a look at this. So far, it's not too interesting.
No. When I came out of this, it went to... How come it's not?
Good question. Is not another mode that you have to...
I'm not sure. So it puts the PowerPoint there automatically, but not...
Oh, I think she's got it over here, though. Didn't she have it on in a separate place on the desk?
Yeah, this was just that same folder, though.
We made arrangements for this with the tech guy a week ago. You can see he's been very responsive.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to stream it to the...
Let me see if I can get somebody.
Okay.
Why don't you play with it until I do it?
Okay.
Showing up on there?
Yeah, it's weird because it puts the PowerPoint there directly, but not the QuickTime. I don't have any idea how to stream it through to.
Usually, if it's on the desktop, it should show up overhead because it's just projecting what you're seeing.
Yeah, and it does with the PowerPoint. But see, even with when the PowerPoint's up, it only projects it when you go into this mode.
Right. But one thing I'm noticing is that. We're not seeing the desktop up there.
No.
Usually, depending on the order that you plug everything in, if you turn it on before you plug it in, you might not get communication between the two.
You
wouldn't want to take this stuff. It doesn't really work the same way with a Mac as it does with a PC.
What do you usually do with a PC to get it to... make the connection? I figured these were the detect displays, maybe?
What is it on right
basic
now?
Basic health law. It's not basic law, so I think
BGA.
Without a first year of law school, you
what do you think of family law, Tori?
She's very
thank you.
Well, I'm going to try to figure out whether these readings are necessary.
We're ready, or we're ready to go.
She seems a little too soft. The way she goes,
I'll just like make another list.
I don't know why we do this.
Virgil attempts to change his life with one bold stroke.
And if you'll just take this to window number 9. What does this say?
Can't you read that?
I can't read this. What's this?
Act natural. No, it's just, please put $50,000 into this bag and act natural.
Well, it does say act natural.
So I'm pointing a gun at you.
That looks like gun. That doesn't look like gun.
No, it's gun.
No, that's gun. That's a B.
No, see, that's an N. It's G. It's gun.
George, would you step over here a moment, please? What does this say?
Please put $50,000 into this bag and app natural. What's app?
Act.
Does this look like gub or gun?
Gun.
See?
But what's app mean?
It's act. A-C-T. Act natural. Please put $50,000 into this bag. Act natural. It's not...
Oh, I see. This is a holdup.
Yes.
May I see your gun? Well, you'll have to have this note initialed by one of our vice presidents before I can give you any money.
See, I'm in a rush.
What?
I'm in a rush.
I'm sorry, but that's our policy. The gentleman in the gray suit.
That's G. Wen. I'm pointing. Yes,
oh, that's a B. That's
I'm pointing
gub.
A gun at you.
Gun.
That's G. Wen.
Well, that's
gun.
A B. That's gub.
No, excuse me. That's an N.
Miss Frank.
I am pointing a gun at you. Apt natural.
No, that's
what
act.
Is apt?
Yeah, that's act.
Oh, it couldn't be. That's a plain B.
No. I'm afraid not. That's act natural. And I'm pointing a gun at you.
Mr.
No,
Miller.
I am pointing a gub.
No, that's gun. That's G. U. N. That's gun. I am pointing a gun at you. No, it looks like a B, but it's an N.
But this one isn't right. It says A, B,
no, that's an S.
Of course it is.
I see it's a gun.
No, it isn't. That's the point.
It
isn't a gun. It has to be. Yes, we discussed this inside. Just a short while ago.
We were there in the window, and it's gun.
If I look at mine, I wouldn't.
Hello, Louise. Listen, I can't make our date today.
Okay. So, as we can see from this very funny Woody Allen clip, we have a situation in which communication is not only critical in a negotiation, but it involves the ability, essentially, of, among other things, of the sender to be able to communicate a message that contains information that the receiver satisfactorily receives and understands. Clearly, the glitch can come on either end of this. Either the sender may not, with sufficient clarity, communicate the intended information, or the receiver, for various reasons we'll understand later, may misapprehend the message, even if in fact it is transmitted with a great deal of clarity. And language, of course, is crucial, be it written and language, spoken language, or body language, or other forms of emoting, in being able to both assure that the message is adequately conveyed and adequately received, and the delicacy of language, both written and otherwise, is infinite. And I like the slide. There is a slide, if you would, going right after communicate. Going the other way. Sorry. There you go. So let's just take a look. For example, this comes from Eats, Shoots, and Leaves by Lynn Truss, which I highly recommend. Just look at, this is a perfect example of the delicacy of language and how the most minuscule thing can completely change meaning. A woman without her man is nothing. A woman without her man is nothing. A little bit different, right? In meaning. And what are we talking about here? A punctuation change. Totally, dramatically altering the meaning of the utterance or communication. Again, we're going to see going on why these problems in communication are really extraordinary complexity when it comes to clinical ethics disputes. And we'll sort of not only see it happening, but we'll be able to understand why it happens, even apart from the problems that come up in the most simple communications, why in those kind of communications the baggage that is there that has to be sorted out is voluminous. Now, can we go back to the terms slide, please? It's not that one, it's the concept. Yeah. All right, so we talked about interdependency and communication. Talk a little bit about rapport building. It's generally known and understood, and not surprisingly so, that when one is negotiating with another, that it is often a great assist in being able to achieve a good process that one engage in rapport building between the participants in advance of the discussion of the substantive material. So that, in other words, if I come to the table to negotiate the price of widgets with you in the proverbial boardroom, when we sit down and I immediately start by quoting what the last sale of widgets were in the state of New Jersey of greater than 500,000 units, that sets a very different tone than if I sit down and say, hi, I'm Ed Bergman, I'm from such and such a place, here's what I do, here's where I went to school, I thought maybe you were familiar to me, turns out, oh, we both went to Penn, turns out that you played tennis, I didn't play tennis, but my girlfriend played tennis, and on and on and on, and believe it or not, there is this literature, it sounds idiotic because it sounds so self-evident, but there are psychology experiments and theories that talk about the liking rule. That's literally what it's called, the liking rule. If I like you, if there are things about you that I can identify with and vice versa, it increases the likelihood of our having a successful negotiation process. So one always wants to bear in mind that there are dialogues in the negotiation, and there are dialogues, and not all of the dialogues are specific to the subject matter or the purported subject matter of the negotiation. A very important notion, perception. Perception in negotiation is everything. That is to say, if I perceive it, I will treat it as real and act accordingly. Therefore, if I am creating a perception that I didn't mean to create, and that unwittingly sets off a response that is really not what I was looking for, but was provoked by that perception that I created, it can throw a huge monkey wrench into any communication or negotiation. And I'd like you to please give me the next video, the one. I think Be Cool is next, but doesn't matter if it is on Be Cool.
It doesn't work like that, okay? I mean, you've got to get the contract back from him, otherwise he still runs the show.
Edie, I was a Shylock. I know how these things work. I've known Nikki for years. You get your contract.
Edie, slight problem.
This could be ugly.
What is that?
That's in LaSalle, who manages and produces the Death MDs.
Tommy owe money?
I would say yes.
Tiffany, man the phones. Hi, get in the office. Look like you know what you're doing. Edie, I want you behind the desk. You're still the boss. These guys need to see that NTL is still in business.
Okay. Where should I hide the books?
Leave them on the desk. And whatever you do, don't mention the Russians.
Don't mention the Russians, okay?
No. Oh, no. We're totally booked. That would have been good. Oh, hang on one second. Sin, honey. How are you?
Enough with the pleasantries. Where's our money, Edie?
Sin.
Sin LaSalle.
Oh, ah! Come on.
No? Okay, you know what? I totally get it, man. I totally get it. First of all, welcome to NTL. Second of all, I want to introduce myself.
Hi, Gordon. I know who you are.
Say.
Capitol Records. 8 years ago, you turned down our demo. Hyman.
You know what, Sin? You know Capitol, man. It's like art by committee over there, okay? Personally, I totally, totally dug all y'all's sound. All right? I'm thinking about leaving Capitol.
Look, Sin, you know, Tommy left his will a mess. You know, if you just give us a few weeks...
Then I call up and the phone is disconnected. Why don't you write us a check for $300,000 and we'll kindly be on our way.
Sin, you know we don't have that kind of money on hand.
Then I need to check your books.
Sin. Be cool.
Be cool? You don't know me.
Oh, I know you a whole lot better than you think I do. Ivy League rich kid, goes to Wharton, gets an MBA, puts on some Timberlands and a throwback, and suddenly you got street cred?
Hey, Sin, look, I'll tell you the truth, okay? The Russians took it.
The what?
The Russians. With one of those insurance scams, you know, like give us half a mil and we won't kill you. And Sin, you knew Tommy, right? I mean, he never wanted any trouble. I mean, he gave him everything we have, but these Russians, okay? These monsters. They're animals. They kept on coming back for more and more, so Tommy told him to get lost. Make a long story short. I'm a widow now.
Excuse me, Chuckles. It's my wife's cousin. I really enjoyed that story, Edie. I mean, Russians, Russians.
I know it's hard, but...
I'm a highly educated man. Sincerely, you don't expect me to believe a story about some Russians. Now, I suggest that you open up those books or things gonna get real ugly up in here.
Sin, the books are none of your business. You'll get the money when NTL has it.
Double. Thank you.
Hoppenby's not going to do you any good. But if you wait till Friday, I get you your money plus the VIG.
Plus the VIG. All right. Okay. Everybody cool out. Everybody calm down. Dabu, calm down. So you saying plus the VIG?
Plus the VIG.
All right. Okay. All right, cool. All right, we're going to do this. Dabu, never get to shoot nobody. Never. Don't never let me do what I want to do. You know, it's a long day, man. You'll get a chance to kill somebody, all right? Calm down. We got some other stops to make today. All right, so I'm not going to kill y'all today. I'm going to be generous. But come Friday, if you don't have my money, the next meeting I arrange will be between you and Tommy Athens, if you get what I'm saying.
I feel you.
You feel me? You... Edie?
Dabu?
Player?
Okay. So here... On the issue of perception, we have the money lender trying to convey in a preposterous manner the notion that he actually is going to kill people if they don't pay the debt, with the retro basketball shirts and so on, and the crazy wife's cousin who, you know, is smarting to shoot somebody and stuff. He has no intention of shooting anybody. He's a sophisticated businessman with a Wharton MBA. But he's trying to create the impression that if, in fact, you don't make the payment, something disastrous is going to happen. In the meantime, Edie, the Uma Thurman character, is somehow trying to convey that she, because of fanciful, dreadful things that have occurred, isn't able to come up with the money that's due now. Now, here is the important part of this. Not only is what you perceive reality for negotiation purposes, but it is only through acquiring information, which you do in preparing for a negotiation, which you do in probing the other parties, meaning asking them questions of a nature that are not just randomized questions, but include such things as open-ended questions, very pointed questions. The pointed questions having the obvious utility of finding out what the other person does or doesn't know, or finding out whether they're being truthful. And the open-ended questions giving you an opportunity to seek information that you wouldn't know how to formulate the questions to ask. Those are very sophisticated things, and it takes a long time to be able to do that. Preparation generally occurs in doing research, both about the identity of the other party, the subject matter of the negotiation, and reputations, for example, of the parties to the negotiation, prior histories of their dealings, both with you and with related or similarly situated parties, and so on. So let me, if I could, have the next video clip, Devil's Avenue.
Thank you. please.
Kevin Lomax.
John Mill.
Nice to meet you.
So, have we been treating you well?
Very well, thank you.
And your wife, she had a good time?
She sure has. It's been great. The whole thing's been great.
That's our secret. Kill you with kindness. What's your secret?
I couldn't say.
You were a prosecutor.
Out of law school. 5 years in the Jacksonville DA's office.
64 straight convictions. What a number!
I like to be in court. I didn't plea out a lot.
But what's that like? One day you're putting them away, next day you're setting them free.
Takes a little getting used to.
Pays better, though, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
That math teacher, the Geddes case. Now, I hear you were brilliant.
Prosecutor dropped the ball.
Really? So you think your guy was guilty?
I didn't say that.
Now, what'd you say?
How's this? I began the case with a clear conscience.
I was sure you had a secret.
The men's room. Upstairs, men's room, the Duval County Courthouse, there's a hole in the wall straight through to the next room. I spend 5 years listening to juries deliberate.
I love it.
Love it all you want, just don't repeat it. I'm not sure the Florida Bar Association would appreciate it.
My lips are sealed. You don't really want to go back to Florida, though, do you? Walk with me. What do you think? Some people can't handle it.
It's peaceful.
My sentiments, exactly. So fill in the resume for me. Tell me, your family, your father, what does he do?
I never got to know my father. He passed away before I was born. My mother raised me. Just the two of us.
She never remarried?
She wasn't married the first time.
Well, that can't be easy in a town like Gainesville, can it?
I don't think it's easy anywhere. Holy shit.
Little different when you're looking down, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Oh, my God.
Your mother. What's she like?
She's a preacher's daughter. She's tough. She's worked at the same poultry plant for as long as I can remember. She's got a church she really likes, so she's usually either there or they go out. They do a lot of volunteer work.
Behold, I send you out as sheep amidst the wolves.
So they say.
I didn't rub off? The book? The church?
No, I'm on parole. Early release for time served.
A lot of potential clients down there.
Are we negotiating?
Always.
Can I ask you a question then? Why do you need a criminal department?
Our clients break the law like anyone else. Just tired of sending their business across the street.
You offering me a job?
I'm thinking about it. I know you got talent. I knew that before you got here. It's just the other thing I wonder about.
What thing is that?
Pressure. Changes everything, pressure. Some people, you squeeze them, they focus. Others fold. Can you summon your talent at will? Can you deliver on a deadline? Can you sleep at night?
When do we talk about money?
Money? Yeah. Well, that's the easy part.
This is a clip that you could talk about in the context of dispute resolution for days, but for our purposes, I'm primarily interested in referring you back to the notion we just discussed before I put the clip on, which is this issue of the need to be able to take perceived reality, since it is your only reality as a negotiator, and to try to make sure that there isn't a big gap between that perceived reality and what I'll refer to, for want of a better word, as objective reality. So you notice that the Al Pacino character had done an incredible amount of homework before this interview. And how do we know that? 64 straight convictions. Ha ha ha. Right? We know that he knew it. We know he knew where the courthouse and so forth. So he, number one, knew enough that if he asked Keanu Reeves a question and the answer had been wrong or less than forthright, he would have known that. But then he also asked open-ended questions, like he asked him, what's your secret, after the statement about the 64 straight convictions, and lo and behold, realistically or unrealistically, Keanu comes out with this admission that he was listening to jurors in the bathroom of the Duval County Courthouse, which is obviously not something that you would be inclined to say to another professional who doesn't know you well, even though, in fact, the context is such that it wouldn't be likely to be repeated. It's a little bit strange to make that kind of statement to the... And yet, because of the difference here between the apparent positions of power and leverage, as well as the differences in preparation by these people, as well as the differences in their probing skills, and the extent to which the Pacino character engaged in active listening, which I'll go back to in a moment. You have a situation where, here, let me give you a hypothesis for what might be have been true here that the Keanu Reeves character would never have known. And this will explain what I mean by the role of perception in negotiation. Reeves walks in to that modern but very fancy and expensive office to have the interview. He sees the dramatic, the fireplace, the severe but expensive furniture, the incredible views, and so forth. Clearly, he is operating out of a basis that includes the perception that he's being interviewed by a very successful, high-powered, well-to-do law firm. Did he ever, do you think, get a Dun & Bradstreet report about this firm in order to prepare for this interview? How the hell does he know that they're not renting the furniture and they're 4 months behind and they're about to repossess the furniture? How do you know that that office isn't on a lease in which they haven't made the rent payments for X number of months? How do you know that they're not a law firm that has billed a ton of stuff that's no longer collectible because their best clients have gone into bankruptcy? Has this Reeves character made those kinds of assessments? Certainly not. But those are the kind of assessments that Pacino made about Reeves' character. When we refer to active listening in negotiation, it goes back to this idea that in negotiation, while of course we know that it is important and meaningful to listen to what the other party says, we're trying to find a way of describing what I will call a heightened sense ability, a heightened attentiveness to all of the stimuli that are coming from the other side or sides in the negotiation. So that means I can't just be listening
for the words. I have to be listening for what I think those words mean in context. Is that guy beginning to sort of bump, twitch his leg up and down every time I mention a particular word or subject? Is the guy looking me in the eye? Or is he looking over my shoulder? Is he sometimes doing one and sometimes the other? Why? When? Is there a certain subject matter that comes up that makes him seem to increase the loudness of his voice by a ton from when the subject is something else? And on and on and on. So the idea is that as negotiators, if we're going to be effective, we have to have all of these skills, and these skills of probing, preparation, and active listening include this heightened ability to have the capacity to absorb and interpret all of the stimuli that's out there, even if it's very subtle, even if it's non-verbal. Okay. Now, can I have just that one?
Which one?
The terms. Keep going. Yeah, negotiation terms. Now, here are terms that are used in negotiation that, again, for those of you who haven't had any negotiation background, should at least have an idea of the meaning of. A resistance point in negotiation is essentially taking the classic bilateral negotiation model of a buyer and a seller, is the point that represents the largest amount that a buyer would pay for the subject, the goods, services, whatever, of the negotiation under any circumstances. Whereas the seller's resistance point, that, by the way, the term is also synonymous with reservation price. Resistance point, reservation, they're both the same. The seller's resistance point is the lowest amount that the seller would accept in exchange for his goods and services under any circumstances. Now, that's a somewhat elusive concept because in reality, although people do come to the table frequently with what they believe are their resistance points, negotiations are living, dynamic things. And during the course of a negotiation, part of my skill as a negotiator may consist of my being able to dissuade you from sticking to what you believe your resistance point was by raising issues that would make you reconsider. Example, you've come to sell me your house, and you've either shared with me or with friends of yours that you would not take a cent lower than $300,000 for the house. I come to the table and I say to you, gee, you know, Barack, the problem is that I just learned that there was a sale down the street. Same square footage, same distance from public transportation, built in the same year, same layout, and so forth. Sold for $250 yesterday. You might have to go back and reconsider. So your resistance point still exists in theory, but it has the possibility of shifting depending upon information that you receive at any time during the negotiation. The bargaining range or the zone of possible agreement is the overlap between the two resistance points. Meaning, if you are willing to pay $300,000, and I am willing to sell for anything over $290,000, the ZOPA, or the bargaining range, is only in that $10,000 gap, unless there is, in fact, a change in the resistance points. Who knows what a BATNA is? Some of you must. Okay.
Best alternative to a negotiated agreement.
Exactly. Best alternative. So think about this in the context of the hypothetical that I just gave. If, in fact, he had a buyer out there who had already offered him, and the offer was still good, $310,000, irrespective of what I just said about that $250,000 recent sale, undoubtedly he would say to me, I don't think that even if you demonstrate to me this example of a like good for a price that was lower a day ago, which, by the way, if you did that, would be your utilization of an anchor. I'm going to go back to the BATNA, but I'm going to show you the relationship. The anchor that I'm using is the $250,000 sale that occurred yesterday as an extrinsic piece of information to support my valuation of the subject matter. Now, I might do the same thing with an appraisal that I got a month ago, right? Or I might do the same thing by bringing in a local realtor to say, I really don't think there's any way you're going to sell this property for less than or more than X to Y, right, in that range. And all of those kinds of things are anchors that you use. Now think about that in negotiations more widely, more generally. That those anchors are not just limited to money, just as we're only simplifying this to talk about the classic buyer-seller single-issue negotiation. This is going to happen where there's an argument about what is the appropriate treatment for a particular kind of disease phenomenon. Because if there's a dispute about that, one of the things that I'm likely to do if I'm Dr. X is to refer you to the well-known dissertation by X, Y, and Z from Columbia University, which opines in the manner that I would like you to determine is appropriate, whereas somebody on the other side of that dispute is likely to refer me to a text from somebody from the University of Pennsylvania who's equally qualified, equally celebrated, and then you have, in effect, two anchors, but they're discordant anchors. But people utilize the anchors to the extent that they can in order to buoy or substantiate what it is that they want the outcome to be. So, again, going back to the BATNA, BATNAs are interesting, too, because we will learn next week, so I don't want to carry this too far. BATNAs, as just as resistance point, BATNAs are also dynamic in a negotiation, meaning it could be that I could improve my BATNA as the negotiation is going by, and one way I would do that is if, in effect, somebody called you on the phone and said, I'll give you $320,000. And then all of a sudden, if our negotiation was still ongoing, you would report to me that your best alternative to resolving this negotiation and bringing it to fruition is to go and take the $320,000. Putting me in a position where it's unlikely that I'm going to get the house if, in fact, I say that my resistance point remains at 300. The reason you need to know about concessions is very simple. And again, it goes back to the psychology literature. Again, many of these things seem after the fact self-evident, but it required a lot of data to be able to have a faith in these conclusions. And guess what? People who negotiate with each other do not feel a sense of satisfaction or comfort unless they receive concessions. In other words, having nothing to do with the, if there is such a thing, the objective value of the goods or services, they want to know that you gave them a concession, that you started at A and that you've moved from A to B. And that makes them happy. Now, I don't know how or why to explain that particular psychological phenomenon, but one of the things that comes to mind for me is that when you talk about many of the negotiations for which these concepts are especially relevant, you're talking about, in fact, a form of negotiation that is called distributive bargaining. And in distributive bargaining, what happens is there is a fixed amount of resources that's being bargained for. And if I get more of the resource than you, I win, in effect. Often referred to as win-lose bargaining as opposed to win-win. You see this in the jargon all the time. I'll talk about that later as well. But at the end of the day, I have the following thesis, and this is essentially at the end of the day what my Wharton students come away with at the end of a semester is a recognition. The fundamental takeaway is the recognition that while in fact when we have all been made aware of negotiation from young ages by looking at media representations of negotiation, which are fundamentally distributive bargains in which there is either a single issue in the bargaining mix, dollars, or there may be other issues, terms, credit, delivery date, whatever. But at the end of the day, the depictions in the movies and on television are that good negotiators are the ones who chew you up and spit you out. Right? They're tough as nails. They shoot from the hip. It has nothing to do with their understanding of the situation, the context, the preparation, all of the other skills that we've been talking about. But they're like tough guys who just go in and wing it. And then they just devour you. Simply devour you. And that's supposed to be a good thing. All right? Now, what that model comes from, if you think about it historically, or sort of in economic historical terms, is what I would refer to as the model that is kind of the Turkish bazaar model, in which somebody is there at a stand with a prayer rug. And you go in and you look at the rug and she says $1,000. And you say, I'll give you $100. And she laughs at you and you say $150. And she laughs at you again and you say $175. You go back and forth and you arrive at a price that's way less than what she was asking and certainly somewhat substantially more than what you were offering. Think about what that really evolves from. It's a one-shot deal. The fundamental dynamics of this reside in the fact that I'm never going to see you again, and you're never going to see me again. Ain't what happens in modern business relationships. Ain't what happens in healthcare. So already you've got to wonder, should we be looking to that model in order to learn about negotiation, in order for us to become mediators who assist people who are negotiating in a clinical context, I think you're going to find that while there will always be, to a degree, the Turkish bazaar one-shot deal modality in negotiation at the margins, it's not fundamentally relevant whether in diplomacy, business, law, or healthcare to the bulk of contemporary negotiations in contemporary life. Okay? And so, although you need to know about these things, and they're not necessarily inapplicable to the negotiations we're going to be dealing with, they're not as dominant a chord or a theme in modern complex negotiations as they were in these one-off negotiations. And just to put a finer point on it, even in the modern world, when you do something that's close to the Turkish bazaar model, such as I sell Caroline my car, it's the used car deal, sort of the kind of classic modern equivalent of the Turkish bazaar thing, here's the problem. Even in that deal in the 21st century, she buys the car, drives it across to California, tells her sister who she bought it from. Her sister says, "That bum, I'm sure he fleeced you. And look, let's go and get the blue book." And sure enough, the blue book shows that you paid me 50 or 100% more than the blue book value of the car. And it's because of the change in the entire communication and internet technology, and information technology, I should say, of the world that sort of changes the parameters of these transactions so that even these little apparently one-off transactions aren't so obviously one-off anymore. Okay. Now, I also want, actually, let me see the slide on distributive bargaining, if I could. Okay, just to finish off on this point. So, distributive bargaining, fixed pie. So again, if I'm selling her my car, the extent every dollar that she pays me is a dollar that she doesn't have, and it's an additional dollar that I do have. And unless we alter the mode of the transaction so other components become added to the bargaining mix, there's really nothing terribly creative, in some sense, about the outcome other than the extent to which I may or may not have and be able to use power or leverage to get my way. And how do I do that? If, in fact, for example, she needs the car more than I need the money, I have more leverage than she does. If there are no other cars, I have more leverage than she does. If these cars are a dime a dozen and there ain't enough buyers, she's got more leverage than I do. But at the end of the day, those are going to be the primary variables along with her actual ability to pay and the extent to which I care about the transaction that generate a process that may or may not lead to an outcome. So what I get, you don't. Commonly referred to as win-lose, commonly associated but with, but not limited to single-issue bargaining over price. Now, why isn't it limited? For the reason I just said a few minutes ago, we could change the house transaction so that in the mix, there's price, there's will I take back a mortgage, at what interest rate, when is the closing date, and what personal property, if any, are included. We could take each issue in that bargaining mix and bargain each of those issues distributively in a way that dealt with all of the terminology that we just looked at a few minutes ago, meaning we could have a resistance point for each of those issues in the mix. It doesn't have to be dollars. My resistance point could be, I will take back a mortgage, but not more than $50,000. Right? And that's my position. Take it or leave it. Or maybe we can talk about it. But if we're bargaining each of the issues in the bargaining mix without reference to the other one, it doesn't have to be money. We could be having the same kind of distributive bargaining about the interest rate, the dollar purchase price, or the term of the taking back of the mortgage, or whether the refrigerator and the air conditioners are included in the deal, or only some of them, or none of them. Okay? And that is fundamentally, the way distributive bargaining works. Now, having said all of this, I want to sort of redirect you for a minute, and I want the video on defending your life.
This is the evening before Mr. Miller took the job in advertising he was to hold until his passing. He asked his wife to help him by playing a little game. Do you remember, Mr. Miller? You asked her to act the boss so you could sharpen your tools in order to get what you wanted.
Do this for me, it helps.
Not now, I'm eating.
Come on, do it.
What do you want me to do?
Be him.
This is silly.
It's not silly, it helps me. Offer me $55,000, no more.
How much do you want?
How much are you offering me?
$55,000.
I can't work here for a penny under 65. I'm sorry.
Well, I can't pay you 65.
Then I can't work here.
58,000.
65.
59?
65.
60?
65.
61.
Let me make it plain. I cannot take the job for under 65 under no conditions.
Your Honors, I would like to go directly to the next afternoon and show you the real encounter.
Daniel, I'm prepared to offer you $49,000.
I'll take it.
I'm going to get you a parking place.
Okay.
Why did you cave in so fast? I'm just curious. Why did you accept so much less money than you wanted and do it so quickly?
Here we go again with money. Obviously, this is all about money. Look, I'm guilty. I didn't make enough money, okay? Call me a hippie, send me to hell. I give up.
You keep thinking it's about money, but it's about fear. Why didn't you stand up to your boss the way you did to your wife? What happened in your mind?
Well, first of all, it wasn't my wife. It was a man with a suit, and the suit had an odor. And the odor said $49,000. I like that very much.
Okay. One of the things that people frequently do not take into account is the reality that not only have we not been trained as negotiators, but in fact, again, in part because of this idea of the negotiation as being a highly charged confrontation of an aggressive sort, and when we think about being placed into that role, we become very anxious. And what was happening here, and what's depicted in this scene, is not really that he altered his view of the importance of being able to make the argument that he was worth what he wanted to get, but rather that when he sat down in front of the other guy in this unfamiliar situation at the bargaining table, he folded. And he folded because he's anxious. Now, many people in negotiations are anxious in all walks of life. It's a perfectly normal thing for you to be anxious. A lot of people are afraid to admit that they're anxious because they think that it doesn't speak well of them. But when they deny the anxiety, it sort of disables them in helping themselves to actually grow into more effective negotiators by learning what the hot buttons are for triggering the anxiety and what kinds of personal tricks, if you will, they might develop in order to diminish the anxiety. But having said that, when you guys start out as fledgling mediators, you will have your own version of the anxiety problem, because suddenly you're no longer just charged with dealing with the interests that you represent at the table. You are now dealing with having to assist multiple parties who themselves may be hampered, whether by anxiety or by other phenomena, in their ability to negotiate effectively, and you feel like you don't quite know what you're doing, and the people who've had the intensive, they know this feeling, that, you know, I'm sort of out there in deep water, and I don't quite know what to do next, and that makes you feel anxious. And so it's very important to recognize that that notion of anxiety is sort of a common denominator in the implementation of this very human phenomenon of negotiation, and it's something that's going to follow you into your role as mediators. You're going to have to deal with it, but dealing with it doesn't mean denying it and pretending. It means sort of accepting it and working with it and engaging in self-examination. Okay. Now, I want to show you something that is not on the travel problem. Can you see if you can take this DVD? Mm-hmm. And did we take it out already? And put it. No, not. Oh, can we play it on there? Did he already put it in there? He or she? It's called Range of Motion. I presume nobody stole it. Does anybody see a disc? Can we, while we're looking for this, can you guys pass this around and have the rest of you fill it out? Let's see if it's in here. Maybe it's in
here, yeah.
Is it in there or is it in here?
Let's see if that's it.
Here you go. Okay. Hold on for a minute. You are going to, I need you to go to basically the 7 minute mark or so.
About the 7 minute mark?
Yeah. Stop. That is not the correct video.
Yep.
Here you go.
It's the wrong video, so take this one out.
Yep. No, I have the right video too. Should be this one then. That one is also of interest. Stick that in there and make sure. Actually, that said, you know what? I am wrong.
I was right.
I'm wrong. And you had the right spot.
want in a brief.
Yeah, but look, they're flimsy. They're going to come apart in the first wash.
You're not supposed to wear them long enough to get them dirty.
Okay, whatever.
He's in a coma, Mrs. Berman. We had to operate to release the pressure from the brain.
Oh, my God. Is he okay?
He's in a coma.
But when does he wake up?
We can't say.
But when does he wake up?
It's too soon to say. He's going to be over 7. Not faster.
Mrs. Berman, may I see you, please?
Yeah.
I know it's difficult for you to accept. It's painful for all of us.
It's been 3 weeks and there are no signs of improvement.
There's been no discernible progress. No vocalizations, no purposeful movement. The signs we look for, there's still sizable swelling on the brain.
There is?
It's important to be realistic. Statistically, there's an 80% chance that your husband will never wake up.
Well, no, there was a woman in Texas who woke up after 16 years.
We can't say he won't. It's just unlikely given his age. And even if he does, there's a strong possibility he could be speech impaired, memory loss, partially crippled, severely disabled.
But there's a possibility that he won't be, isn't there?
I'm chief of neurology here, Mrs. Berman. I realize this is hard for you to accept, but there's nothing more we can do for your husband.
There must be new technologies, new discoveries every day.
We don't have any way to help him.
Well, but what have you tried? You haven't tried anything.
We're sorry.
Excuse me. I've got to get back to my patients. Good luck, Mrs. Berman. Well,
good luck? Is that it? Well, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Will not back to the dumpster?
Mrs. Berman, listen.
No, you listen. That is my husband in there. The father of my children. He is a very active man. He does not like being in bed. He hates being in bed unless he's a sleeper. Don't you understand? This can't be happening, Jay.
We can't keep your husband any longer, Mrs. Berman. It's costing almost $5,000 a week, and your insurance won't cover it. And frankly, we need the space for patients we can't help.
I know it's hard to think of long-term convalescent care, but
I'm not going to put him in some home.
You can't take care of him by yourself. He needs round-the-clock nursing care.
This just can't be happening.
Perhaps some counseling might be in order for you.
We'll help you make other arrangements.
You call yourselves healers?
Excuse me.
You call yourselves healers? You're hypocrites! You don't care about Jay. What you care about is your percentages, your statistics. Well, my husband is not a statistic! He is my husband!
Well, when we transfer what we've been talking about into the real world and into the clinic, I think even though we're jumping kind of far kind of soon and we're going to backpedal the next few weeks, I just want you to see how the stuff we were talking about relates to this kind of situation where the communication, for starters, is obviously horrible.
the notion of something like rapport building is non-existent. The idea of active listening is rendered moot by the fact that they have no interest in hearing what her true concerns are, as distinct from theirs. When we go back to the original definition, remember, of, can we get that negotiation defined back again? Joint decision-making process. See any joint decision-making processes in there? I didn't. Through which two or more interdependent parties. If I'm reading this correctly, what happened is that the medical team unilaterally ended the interdependency by declaring him no longer within their purview. Ergo, there's nothing to talk about. Ergo, good luck, Mrs. Berman. End of story. So, you know, no joint decision making, sort of a unilateral eradication of the interdependency. And whether we call this a dispute or the creation of a shared vision, where was the attempt to create a shared vision as among these caregivers and the wife of the man in the coma? There wasn't any. And so while there may be conflicting interests, and there certainly were, to wit, the issue of how do you support keeping someone in a coma in the hospital at the rate of $5,000 a day without the insurance payment, versus Mrs. Berman's interest in keeping her husband alive because she believes that he will either by himself emerge from the coma, but perhaps unspoken is the off-stated premise that maybe if someone is continued on life support, there may be a new kind of intervention that is developed during that hiatus period that will make cure or improvement possible. Now, what makes that clip, I think, somewhat interesting is that it isn't that either articulated position is crazy. In other words, it may indeed be the case, and there is an enormous literature and concern in modern medicine about when further attempts to either sustain life or intervene is or isn't appropriate or isn't futile. And there are important, and we'll see this as we go along throughout the semester, important reasons to accord ethical respect to both of the points of view that are being articulated, because neither of them is either a function of the desire of the caregivers or the wife to harm the husband for self-seeking motives. They both presumably want the best interests of the patient, but maybe the caregivers have somewhat confused the question of the best interest of the patient with the best interest of the hospital as an entity and its ability to deal with the patients. But in any event, the question of whether to cease the life support is not a debate in which you can out of hand dismiss one or the other point of view. And yet the lack of respect that was accorded by the caregiver team to the desire and need of the wife to maintain, at least for a time, her husband's being alive, so that, who knows, maybe what is required is that she be given an opportunity to digest emotionally
what is really occurring here, and that there could be a point down the road in which acceptance of the finality of this is something that she would consider. But she was preempted from ever being put in that spot by the way in which the negotiation / communication was implemented, with utter insensitivity as well as with poor communication. Now, I think you can see from this, and this is why I showed it, even though it's a little early on to be bringing this into the classroom, I think it enables you to get a picture of how mediation as an assisted negotiation might be able, and we're not going to talk about how today, that'll come later, and when and so on, might be able to aid these parties in crafting a dialogue that looks quite different than this one and seems much more humane than what we just witnessed, and leaves, even in the event that they can't reach a resolution, leaves all of the parties with the sense that the differences in their points of view are not predicated on what the wife was screaming, which was, you call yourselves healers, you're hypocrites. Perhaps there are things that she could learn about these people that might help her to reinterpret the question of what their behavior means. For example, what are the real pressures on this hospital, on that neurology department? What really does happen in situations like this, and what could we anticipate would be the outcome if, in fact, every Mrs. Berman, not just this one, but everyone, was able to simply say, you must keep my husband in the hospital in perpetuity. Now, the hospital did not, no representative of the hospital, to my way of thinking, articulated the real reason why he couldn't be in the hospital, meaning that the hospital exists for a certain kind of acute care that apparently was inapposite to the needs of this particular patient. That is not synonymous with saying, as Mrs. Berman thought, that we're going to dump him in the trash. And she also assumes that when they talk about a facility, that has to mean a horrible, impossible to tolerate, cacophonous, additionally unresponsive, unprepared institution that's going to be non-responsive to either the patient or the family's needs. Now, indeed, it may be that that's the case with the real options, and this film goes on to depict some pretty grisly ones. But on the other hand, what if there were a joint endeavor between the caregivers and the wife to try to collaborate regarding options that might be employed, examining what they all are and looking at the negatives and the positives of the options, but at the same time, recognizing the importance of the feelings of one another, so that this idea of the chief of neurology saying to Mrs. Berman, good luck, Mrs. Berman, I don't know about you, but I mean, that was pretty preposterous, wasn't it? Good luck? I mean, what the hell is he talking about there? And you notice, and clearly the filmmaker was very aware of all these things, because you notice as it gets to the end of the scene, they hammer you with the following things. We'll get you some, in effect, therapy, because your problem is you're nuts. Or at least the inference can be drawn, yes, we have a problem here, but the problem isn't that you have a husband who was perfectly healthy one minute, went out to jog, fell on a rock, hit his head on the rock, and is now in a coma, and nobody knows what's going to happen, and there's been no time to process this. And yet they're implying that she just needs help, which can be interpreted perception, right? They will undoubtedly, given an opportunity to address these issues, probably indicate that that isn't the way they meant it. What they really meant, they would be likely to say, is we know that when people are struck with a devastating blow to a loved one and their life seems to change before their very eyes, regardless of how stable psychologically they may be, that level of stress is something that might be helped by getting some lateral support from not just a doctor, but somebody who is either a religious person in their lives, a psychotherapist, a psychiatrist, whatever, but it doesn't have to be viewed as a demeaning suggestion. And yet when it's made in this kind of insensitive, running up the score kind of way, it is almost impossible to read it as being containing empathy, right? And then, to make matters worse, the other woman comes in from the hospital and basically recites the $5,000 a day business as being, you know, the final nail in the coffin, so to speak. And again, if we go back to the interview or the negotiation, the dialogue in the room with the x-rays, they are spouting statistics, but they're not talking about this patient as though this patient is an individual human being with a life and with a family and what the repercussions are here. You know, they think they're doing it, but they're doing it in such a clipped, incommunicative, insensitive manner that it's actually doing more harm than good. And as we go along, I think we're going to be able to get a handle on the question of how it is that to the extent that we can't improve the quality of communications and negotiated responses between caregivers and family members, or between, I might add, family members and other family members, or family members and the patient, and so on, how those situations can be aided by a neutral who understands something about how to unravel these knots and make it possible for the people to actually speak to each other rather than at each other. And I hope that by the time the semester is over, this stuff will now feel quite natural to you, what the relationships are between these things that are written in the books and how this is actually relevant to what happens in the clinical setting where people's real lives and families and futures are involved. I'm sorry, that's yours. Okay. Forget it. I was thinking of a different slide that I didn't want to use. Okay, so I'm going to stop at this point, but I want to make sure that, number one, everybody signed the sheet with the emergency stuff. And you all know what the readings are for next week. And everybody knows my email if they need to contact me. Now, during the weeks in which we're not doing a game, I'll try to let you out by 6:30 or 6:45 at the latest. As the semester goes on, when we're doing some complex games, it's going to be tough to get out before 7. And so I want to, you know, give you the benefit of getting out now, because I know that's going to happen when we're debriefing some of the role plays. Okay? Anybody have any questions? All right. Yeah, Ken.
Where's the sheet?
Where? Who has, oh, there it comes. Okay. No, getting to yes, you have to get the book. Okay, and the same for bioethics mediation. Okay, only the bulk pack materials on that. Other questions? I look forward to seeing you next week, and I hope we're going to have a lot of fun and learn a lot at the same time.
I think you just have to bring him back.
Oh.
Oh, you can't access the blackboard.
I guess we can.
Because you're not in
but I'm going to give you. We should have
my stuff in the building.
I'm really bored. Yeah, I constantly do it.
But it sounds way better than
Because the only thing about that is like to get like things done right away. But
okay.
I thought well, I'm doing the one this weekend.
Did you guys want to take this
lesser push, but not maybe it's only intense, but somehow it doesn't all
happen.
We
have
a
lot of
power,
so
we have
they would have, they know what we're doing, like they would have told us.
This is a hand in the
I have so good. So what, did you do an extra class or a research paper? Or
what? I did a seminar with my senior writer.
Oh, right.
I just had it written up formatted. She didn't even ask for the paper, but I'm assuming it was fine.
Okay. I did the journal, and they had, like, you could have been done all the stuff, and then, like, just, like, ready for a break. She's like, oh, well, I need, like, a signature from the center of the
stock. Yeah, that's what I had to do.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
She didn't do it beforehand.
She didn't beforehand, so she just did, like, a month ago, and, like, now I just haven't found Ruger in the law school at all. Like, I emailed them to reply, so I'm just, like, hoping about
the I sent that to her. She gave me the form when I did it last day. But they didn't ask for the paper.
I just, like, I, like, took out, like, the intro paragraph to, like, the actual and the description of the paper, so I just, like...
Yeah, I just hand-wrote a very...
Okay, I should probably do that, because mine doesn't sound...
So I literally would, like, yeah, this paper's not informed, exactly. I mean, obviously, the more fair it is,
Do you have a map?
Well, at some point it becomes a problem. I don't think in your case it will.
Josh,
right. I think you'll be okay. But you should also feel free.
Hey, I'll see you tomorrow. I got to run.
Okay. Nice to have you.
You know what? Let me ask you. I remember you sending me your email. Right. And then I told you to go to audit, right?
Didn't you ask me if it was okay for you to be in the
back? No, yeah, because I signed for the class, but as a senior here at UVA, because I'll be pronounced like undergraduate within 3 years, and so administrative problems. And then someone I remember who replied that I couldn't take the class, and then I had to explain that I was a grad student in France, and that's why I ended up here. But I don't think I.
You didn't send me an email asking if I was permitted to come to class.
Maybe, yes.
I think we did. I sent you, if you're a good person I'm thinking of, I sent you to talk to Autumn
Field.
You didn't? Okay. Maybe it wasn't me. All right, but we're glad to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your class. I have two questions. The first one is about the group that you said we could write a check.
No, no, you're thinking of something else.
On the Blocker site, it said for the bioethics mediation book that a check for $15 could be made out.
No, I don't know why it still says that.
Okay, so
that was the old edition when it was out of print.
I see.
This should...
Right. It's. I mean,
pen books.
Sure, that's fine. It's just online. That's what it said. So I
It's not applicable anymore. I'm glad you asked me.
Okay. And the second question I had, I apologize.
No apology necessary. That's why I'm here.
I am the editor in chief of one of the journals at Penn Law, and we have a large symposium event next Thursday, January 19th.
Okay.
That starts at 6:00.
Okay.
So I think that because I'm going to deliver remarks and things of that nature.